This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Now get the guns, the drugs from my generation. I'll take the fall, the saint, and across the nation. And it's a sin, the guns, the fake, the fraud, the messing with me. Come on, come on, come on, let's get it out.
Welcome, everyone, to Monday Night Raw!
Actually, welcome to the hard-traveling fanboys. I am Greg Phillips.
Strangely enough, though, our show is often uncut, uncooked, and uncensored.
And uncensored. That's right. With me, as always, you can hear his voice on the other side of the L-shaped Vancouver, British Columbian studios right there, is Nick Duke. Nick, how are we doing on this fine nondescript day or night in which we're recording?
I'm doing very well, and I'm thankful so far that to this point I have not been shaken up and moved over to the Sellers Points podcast.
That's right. We haven't informed everyone that we're going through a bit of a PTBN Pop superstar shakeup.
Yep.
That's right. You never know who might pop up on whose podcast, and, you know, there may even be a situation in which the Sellers Points podcast no longer has Russell Sellers in it.
That would certainly be a unique situation.
That would be. Maybe he'll go over and host Geek and Sassy, and Nick can go and host Sellers Points, and I can go host the NBA team.
Oh, he got it right for once.
That's right. And the Lucha Undead guys can come host our show.
Well, that would be unique. For sure.
Certainly. It's all on the table right now.
And we won't know until they just randomly show up on the podcast, I'm pretty sure.
That's right. That's right. All we're going to let you know is that the podcast general managers are undergoing discussions behind the scenes as we speak.
And our general manager? You guessed it. Frank Stallone.
Frank Stallone. Yep. So if Mr. Stallone can get up rest of the general managers, which I'll let the other shows disclose their general managers at a given time. And, you know, that's not even talking about the chairman, Gerard Depardieu, and what he might have to say about all this. We don't even know.
Or the CEO. But as for now, we're still here. Or the COO, Peter David.
Oh, yes, friend of the PTBN world. The PTBN Nation world, I don't know if that really works.
Not sure.
A friend of PTBN. In any event, we are still here for now, and we are gathered for an illustrious occasion. Tonight is another exciting installment of Countdown, where we count down favorite or least favorite in the history of comics and comics-related media, ladies and gentlemen. And boy, we've just got a packed show tonight, because we are going to be counting down the top five issues from the historic New 52 Batman run from writer Scott Snyder and artist Greg Capullo.
Yeah.
Good idea, Greg. Yes, that's what the show has for us tonight. I can't wait to delve into it.
You're a real bastard, you know that? But yeah, that is the plan. We were not originally sure if that was going to be the plan, because when we first talked about this episode of Countdown, we had said just the top five Scott Snyder written Batman issues, much like we did for our Jeff Johns Green Lantern Countdown a couple of months ago. And then Greg apparently took that to mean Snyder and Capullo, and then we quickly realized there were so many good Snyder and Capullo issues, we could easily just pick five out of their 51-issue run.
Right, and so that's where we have it. Now, as a little bit of background before we get started, Scott Snyder had written Batman before the New 52. In fact, he was writing Detective Comics right up through the beginning of the New 52 in August of 2011. Now, his Detective Comics run has been collected in the outstanding graphic novel Batman the Black Mirror, which both Nick and I have extremely high praise for. I consider it to be Scott Snyder's masterpiece, his greatest Batman work, even though it features Dick Grayson in the titular role. But not to be deterred, when the New 52 started, DC Comics paired up Scott Snyder with veteran artist Greg Capullo, who was probably best known for his work on Spawn, but right. who had also drawn X-Force for a number of years back in the 90s for Marvel. So very much in the Jim Lee family of artists. And that led to what would become the most consistent creative team in the New 52 initiative. Not once was there a creative overhaul on the book.
Nope.
They were able to, from the beginning to the end of the New 52, essentially, they were able to stay together and to put together, I believe, 51 or 52 issues.
Actually, the number's going to be a little bit less than that because, you know, there were some fill-in artists here and there.
True.
So probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 45 to, you know, sounds about right. I know, for example, there's a two-parter Clayface arc that was not done by Capullo. I know there's a Becky Cloonan Robin Requiem issue that was not done. I don't think issue 52 was done by Capullo. So it's just, you know, there are some issues here and there that don't have his art on it. But Snyder, I believe, wrote the entire thing.
Yes, and most of it was drawn by Capullo. The main stories were all drawn by Capullo.
Yes, absolutely.
Whenever
yes,
he was not on it, it was a stand-in issue, a fill-in issue, an in-between story between the larger story arcs. And from beginning to end, that's really rare these days. You don't see that in comics, hardly ever, in mainstream superhero comics. One creative team to stay on a book for that long. What was it, 11 through early last year, right? So that was about a 5-year run.
Yeah, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Give or take.
Which is exceedingly rare, yeah, like you said.
Yep. So with all that being said and all the background out of the way, let's get started on our countdown. And I am going to kick us off with my number 5 issue of the Snyder Capullo run. And appropriately enough, it is the very first issue of Batman and the New 52. It is Batman Volume 2, Issue 1. And the reason this made my list is when you start a run, what you know is going to be, or you anticipate to be, a long run on a book, you want to kick it off with a bang. You want to have a mission statement in your first issue. This is what this book is. This is what this book is going to be. This is what you can expect if you subscribe to this book and read it every month. And Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo from the jump start out with an action-packed scene in Arkham Asylum with what appears to be Batman and the Joker working side by side, which is a crazy idea, only to find out halfway through the issue, or a few pages into the issue, not quite halfway, that it wasn't actually the Joker, of course, and it was Dick Grayson in disguise. And you get Snyder in one of the rare instances where he got to write the entire Bat family in this issue, minus Jason. You get him writing Damian, Dick, Tim, Bruce, Alfred, all together at once, which is really cool.
Including
you also
one of the absolute best Damian one-liners of all time, probably.
Go ahead and give it to us, Nick.
So they're showing a little sequence of Batman, of Bruce testing out some facial recognition software through his contact lens, and Dick goes, "Don't tell me you need to use facial recognition software at this point, Bruce." I think Tim says it, and Damian goes, "He doesn't need it. He's just trying to remember who you are, Drake."
which is perfect. That is so Damian. And it almost makes me sad that we haven't seen Snyder write Damian as much as he has other characters. And the reason for that is he said on Twitter that he finds it uncomfortable to write a character that young, since he has a young son about the same age as Damian, or that will soon be about the same age as Damian. But he writes him really well, and that shows it in the very first issue. We also have an introduction to the kind of tech that you mentioned, that facial recognition software. This is a very tech-heavy run from beginning to end. Both Snyder and especially Capullo really seem to hone in on the geeky side of Batman. New gadgets, new putting his money to good use, basically. So you see a whole lot of tech throughout this 50-some-odd issue run, and it all starts here in the very first issue. You see that. You see the patented the Greg Capullo action scenes, which are so crisp and so clean and so smooth. Just seeing him cut loose on some of the classic B and C list villains in Arkham Asylum is wonderful. And also getting a chance to see how he differentiates the faces of these characters and draws them distinctly, and how he, from the very first issue, his storytelling ticks mesh so well with Scott Snyder's storytelling ticks. So, like, Snyder comes from a horror writing background. Capullo comes from Spawn, which is a very horror-oriented title, and they just mesh. The colors also. I don't want to leave out. We talk about Snyder and Capullo and this being their run, but I also want to talk a little bit about the colorist FCO Placentia, who was the colorist throughout this entire run. And I would argue, Nick, I don't know if you feel this way too, that just as much as Capullo's line work, FCO's colors define this Scott Snyder Batman run to me. This when I think about it, I think about unusually bright, vibrant colors in Gotham. It's an approach to Gotham I don't think that we had ever seen before, and it's an approach that I will forever associate with this particular creative pairing.
I agree. I agree wholeheartedly with that, and I actually have one issue that I'm going to talk about that a little bit later on in the show. But yeah, I echo all your thoughts on this one. And just to let people know, I used a very similar methodology as I did for the Geoff Johns Green Lantern podcast that we did a couple months ago, where I used internet synopses to kind of jog my memory of each individual issue, and then narrowed it down to a list of 6 issues that I then actually went back and physically reread last night. And this one was the one that just missed the cut. So if this was a top 6, it would be on my countdown as well. Very high regard for this one.
I also wanted to shout out the other patented Scott Snyder thing that this comic book has in the very first issue, a killer cliffhanger.
Yeah.
With Dick Grayson's DNA being found on a knife, on a murder weapon, basically.
Yep.
Set the stage for what would turn into a pretty consistently engaging cliffhanger ending to almost every Snyder and Capullo issue. Just kept you wanting to – it gave you a compelling story, but it made you want to read the next issue. And very high praise for this one from me.
Absolutely, absolutely. Moving on to my number 5, and I think Greg will be a little surprised at how low I have this one on my countdown. But one of the things we're going to talk about throughout this countdown, I'm sure, is how the expert plotting and characterizations from Scott Snyder are really what hooked me on this Batman run. Not to say I'm not a huge fan of Greg Capullo's art, because I am. But there was one instance where, in my opinion, the rare instance in this run where Capullo took the reins of the book and completely outshined Scott Snyder's writing. And that was in the final chapter of Endgame. So at number 5, I have Batman number 40. And this features the final confrontation in the New 52 anyway, between Batman and the Joker. Endgame was a fantastic story that had weaved, you know, many plot threads in and out. You had the question over, was the Joker truly immortal? You had the ticking time bomb of what was going to happen to all the Gothamites who had been infected by the Joker's latest toxin. And finally, you wound up with this climactic confrontation deep beneath Gotham City, where this chemical known as Dionysium is, and Batman is seeking to obtain it from the spine of the Joker in order to develop a cure for the rest of Gotham. And these two characters who have, you know, already met once in the Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo run in very dramatic fashion, have what is absolutely one of the most brutal Batman-Joker hand-to-hand fights I've ever seen.
Yep.
Typically, I don't like when the Joker is presented as a hand-to-hand equal for Batman, but in this issue, for some reason, it just worked for me. And I think part of the reason is the savagery of the fight, where you get the impression that the Joker is not pulling his punches anymore. There's no pretense left. He is not doing this out of some sort of bizarre affection for Batman. For once, he is finally out for blood. And Batman seems to be the same. And there's a little moment in the fight that I absolutely love, because you've got a couple of pages of these two just going at each other, I mean, hardcore, and then they randomly stop in the middle of the fight, and you see both of them just huffing and puffing and catching their breath to get over, like, the sense of exhaustion and the sense of, you know, just the sense of physical exertion that these two are putting into every blow. And then when the finale of the fight comes, and it's Batman and the Joker laying side by side, as all of Gotham collapses around them, and you see, you know, you always thought it would be the other way around. You always thought that if the Joker were heading to his death, he would be the one calling to Batman to come be his friend and lie next to him. And here you see Batman embracing his impending doom and pulling the Joker into this bizarre embrace as the city crumbles around them. It is just a beautiful series of images from Greg Capullo, yeah. And for my money, his high water mark on this book.
Yeah, I agree with all of what you just said, so much so that I can't talk about the book quite yet because it will pop up a little bit later on for me. But that it's a great issue. I mean, everything you touched on, the artwork, I agree. This was the artistic high water mark. Not that there was ever a drop off, really.
No, of course
not. At any point, but this was the high water mark artistically. It was incredible.
Yep.
So let's move on to my number four issue on the countdown, and this is Batman number 49. This is Super Heavy Part 9, and the reason that this makes my list, I would say that Super Heavy ultimately for me was probably my second least favorite of the story arcs that Snyder and Capullo did. Not that it was bad by any means. I enjoyed it consistently. I thought it was very good, but it didn't hook me the way that the others did. But that being said, this issue is one of the best Batman issues of the modern era to me. It's that good, and that shows you how good I think the books in front of it are to say that. But this is a book in which an amnesiac Bruce Wayne has finally accepted the fact that he was once Batman. And you get an issue where Alfred painstakingly is going through every possible means to convince Bruce not to become Batman again. All that he wants is for Bruce to be happy and healthy and safe. And as a result of Endgame, for the first time in his life, Bruce is all those things. He is happy. He is healthy. He is...
Because he doesn't remember his traumatic past. I think we should mention that.
Right. He's like I said, he's
right.
Forgotten large swaths of his past. His traumatic... All of his traumatic memories have been expunged from his brain, right?
Yeah. So as a result of the injuries suffered at the end of Endgame and the Dionysium, that chemical... restoring him, it restored him to like his optimum self, including his brain. So his brain has kind of been reset a bit without all the emotional and traumatic scarring of his superhero tenure and even his early childhood.
Right. So as a result, he's able to be happy. He's able to find a steady girlfriend. He's able to work at some sort of a shelter to help kids. He's really got happiness for the first time in his life. And Alfred just wants that to stay. But anybody that knows Batman, anybody that knows Bruce, knows he can't let that stay. Because deep down in him, at his core, he is Batman. And much like in the classic Batman the Animated Series episode, Perchance to Dream, which this comic reminded me of, there's just – he cannot accept it. He can't accept the happy fantasy. He wants the harsh reality. And even though Alfred knows that it's futile, even though he knows that it's going to happen, that Bruce is going to embrace this, Alfred can't let it go without a fight and begs Bruce at one point, begs him not to do this thing. And Bruce finally activates this machine that brings all the memories back to him. And it is a heartbreaking issue because you see that pain in Alfred's face. You see that the one person in the world probably who cares about Bruce Wayne the most, I would say, you see that he is broken because he knows that it's back to the old ways now. It's back to Bruce being self-destructive. It's back to Bruce putting himself on the line every night. And it's back to Alfred having to worry about not being able to piece him back together again. Just a heartbreaking issue from Alfred's standpoint. And also, in some ways, an optimistic and an inspirational issue from Batman's side. So it's almost like this yin and yang. Of the inspiration of Batman reclaiming his throne, but the sadness of Alfred watching this happen.
Absolutely. I agree with a lot of what you just said. And in an odd parallel, my number four is actually Batman number 48, the issue that immediately preceded this one. And this is another installment of the Super Heavy storyline, but this features... This is at a point where Bruce is slowly starting to come to the realization of what he was in a past life and what must be done. And this issue features, you know, in addition to some of the Mr. Bloom stuff that's going on throughout Gotham, so you get kind of a little snippet of what the main Super Heavy arc was about, with Gordon running around as Batman and Bloom infecting the city with all his seeds, and you get the character of Duke Thomas and the character of Darrow and the character of Julia Pennyworth all serving integral roles. But really, the highlight of this issue is a scene they keep coming back to where it's Batman, or excuse me, I should say it's Bruce Wayne, who doesn't really fully realize that he was Batman quite yet, and the Joker, who doesn't realize really that he's the Joker quite yet, having a conversation on a park bench. And the whole thing is filled with such tension and such an ominous feeling that it's absolutely amazing. It is a version of the Batman-Joker discussion that these two characters so often have that I've truly never seen. Every moment where you think it's going to take a dire turn, somehow it just turns out to be innocuous and harmless. And it's such a great subversion on the interaction between these two characters that it's... I just can't say enough about that scene. But as you mentioned, you know, FCO Placentia, fantastic coloring throughout this title. I have another issue I want to shout him out for in particular later on the countdown, but his colors on the Mr. Bloom character in particular were always fantastic, I thought.
Yeah.
And the reason this really made my list is, you know, you gave it, you mentioned it for the entire issue, but for me, you know, because it plays out in the entire issue of 49, but for me, the combination of that Joker-Batman scene with the closing scene of the book where Gotham is under attack, it's under siege, and you cut to Wayne Manor, and all you see is a door that's being beat on, and you see on the other side is Alfred sitting there, and he has this terrified, stricken look on his face because he knows what's on the other side. And eventually, yep. Bruce kicks down the door and demands that Alfred takes him to his cave, and you see Alfred clutching himself and crying because he knows that all of that happiness that Bruce has had is about to come crashing down around him. And it is just a heartbreaking finale, or a heartbreaking closing image to a fantastic issue. So Batman 48 is my issue of Super Heavy that I chose to put on the countdown.
And as we all know, Nick, when it comes crashing down,
It often hurts inside. That's true.
Yep. You've got to be a man. It don't help to hide.
That's true. And Alfred could no longer hide. So there you are.
And that just made the list.
Indeed.
Now, moving on to my number three issue. And by the way, all I want to say about what you just mentioned, great issue. I went back and forth between 48 and 49 on mine. Mm-hmm. Excellent issue. The scene with Batman and the Joker on the park bench, or Bruce and the Joker on the park bench, is an all-timer for sure.
Right. I think the only reason 49 didn't make mine is because some of that alternate reality Batman stuff, you know, where he's going through the machine, was mm-hmm. a little bit out there for my taste, but I still overall enjoyed it.
My number three issue is labeled as the first issue of the second part of Zero Year, Dark City, but it's really the conclusion of the first chapter of Zero Year, and that would be Batman number 24, and this wraps up the Secret City story arc and kicks off Dark City, which are the first and second of the three-part Zero Year story arc. And why did this make my list? Well, it's very simple. It has nothing to do with the overarching story of the Red Hood Gang, which was a great story that played out over the first part of the Zero Year. But what makes it make my list is, to me, more than any other issue in their run, this is the mission statement of who Batman is to Scott Snyder. And it's really summed up in a quote that he gives at the end of this issue. Scott Snyder's Batman is not the Batman of Jeff Loeb or the Batman even of Frank Miller. Scott Snyder's Batman is rooted in hope. He is rooted in optimism, not in the same way that Superman is, but in a darker version of that, because Bruce Wayne, under Scott Snyder's penship, does what he does only because he genuinely has hope for Gotham. He believes that Gotham City can be saved.
He believes that Gotham City can turn the corner, and he believes that Bruce Wayne has a part in that journey, as does Batman. And this issue sums that up because we see the climactic fight between Bruce and the Red Hood gang leader, who obviously we all believe to be the Joker. We see that climactic battle here. We see Batman finally outsmart the Red Hood for the first time in this story arc, really. He ends up coming out the other end. But we also see Bruce...
the rear end.
The rear end, if you will. The rear view, even.
Oh, man.
You get a nice murder mystery that comes up because you find a fake version of the Red Hood body out in the dumpster. So it does leave a little bit of that ambiguity about Joker's origin out there. And you get this incredible speech from Bruce to the city of Gotham that is basically telling them that, look, it will get better. We will recover from this. We will, you know, I will save this city, you know, and, you know, he's able to summarize in one speech to the city pretty much why he does what he does as Batman, but also why it's important that Bruce Wayne does what he does. And I think that this issue is a beautiful finale to this first part of Zero Year, which, by the way, was my favorite of the, if you count it as one story, Zero Year. I loved it. I thought it was a brilliant Batman origin that deserves its spot on the bookshelf next to Year One. But this was a wonderful finale to that initial arc in there. Wraps up the Red Hood thing in a very satisfying manner. Shows Batman at his most clever, using his mind, not just his fists. And also shows that overwhelming sense of optimism that Scott Snyder has in his Batman that mixes with the grit and with the cynicism. Because it's a take on Batman that is at once fresh and new, but also still true to that initial character from way back in the 1930s. So for all those reasons, this issue is my number three of the run.
Gotcha. Yeah, I also enjoyed Zero Year a great deal. Probably not as much as you did, but I have an issue from Zero Year that also made my count down that I'll talk about here in just a little bit. But for my money, the high water mark of the Snyder and Capullo run, I counted as one story, is the first 11 issues, which is Court of Owls and Night of Owls. So I've got an issue here for my number three. I'm going with Batman number 10. And this is the ultimate reveal of who has kind of been pulling the strings behind all the events that we see in Night of Owls and Court of Owls. And the ultimate reveal of the character of Lincoln March is finally made. Who he claims to be, what he claims to want from Bruce, and the bizarre connection that he says the two have. A connection that, you know, is left ambiguous, but is heavily hinted in the backup to this issue that it could potentially be true. And it's a question, you know, essentially, this book's 5 years old at this point, so I'm going to spoil it a little bit. Lincoln March claims to be Bruce's once-thought-dead brother, Thomas Wayne Jr. And in the backup, we see a little... The backup focuses on Alfred's father, Jarvis, caring for a pregnant Martha Wayne. And he talks about them heading somewhere, and he says, and then everything ended on the corner of Lincoln and March, hinting that this character of Lincoln March knows more than Bruce thinks he knows, and that this could potentially actually be a true brother to Bruce Wayne. But that whole reveal sequence of Lincoln March, Bruce piecing it together and not wanting to believe that he's piecing it together at the same time, is just an example of Snyder's mastery of this character, how he writes Batman, and how he writes the distinction between Batman's interior monologue and what Batman says out loud. It's just a great example of why I love Scott Snyder on this character, and why the Court of Owls and Night of Owls storyline was so perfect. And major props to Capullo for drawing the resurrected Lincoln March to look creepy as hell. Just a great character design on the part of Mr. Capullo. So I love everything about Night of Owls and Court of Owls, and this is one of the issues of that takes up a spot in my top three.
Yeah, all the things you just said. This was actually my first one out. This was number six for me on my list. Barely missed the cut for me. A damn near perfect issue, like you said. This was the Lincoln March reveal. I know some people didn't like it. It worked for me because it's left ambiguous. It doesn't come out and tell you. You know, you can choose to believe him, or you can choose not to believe him.
If you don't like the reveal, then you can read it to not believe him. I mean, that's the reason it's written that way.
But one of the reasons, the underlying thematic reasons that I think I love this issue and this storyline so much of the Court of Owls is, again, one of the things that Snyder did through the course of his Batman run that we really had not seen done with Batman in a long time, in my opinion. Because we've had, you know, as the joke goes, Bat God, basically, where we've had creators do kind of more of an over-the-top superhuman take on Batman, kind of. You know, we've had that for a long time, where he's the smartest guy in the room, the best fighter in the room, and all this stuff. And that's fine. That's great. Most of the great Batman stories are like that. Snyder goes a different way with it. Because, yes, he's still the best fighter, he's still the smartest man and all that, but he's also very flawed and vulnerable. And part of the Court of Owls, or a big part of the Court of Owls, is taking Bruce Wayne's arrogance and exposing him to his own arrogance. Because he thinks he knows this city. He knows better than all the nooks and crannies. He knows everything about its history, only to learn that he really didn't know anything about it after all. And the same thing that you see play out over the course of the Lincoln March reveal. He doesn't want to leave any of this because in Bruce's mind, he knows everything. He knows his past, certainly. And then it exposes to him that, wait a minute, if I don't know my own family history, what the hell do I know about the rest of this city? So it's a great job of kind of breaking the character down. And over the course of these 50 issues or this 5 years, Snyder humanizes Bruce Wayne, humanizes Batman in a way that had not been done in decades, to the point where by the end you see a Batman who is more human, as William Shatner might say. Indeed. And to me, it's a brilliant, brilliant take on the character and a bold take on the character.
Agreed wholeheartedly. Yeah, they, as you said, many writers have given Batman an almost omnipotent power of prediction, where nothing could ever surprise him, and Snyder certainly turned that on its ear.
Certainly. On to my number two issue of the run, and we're going to stay in Zero Year, and we're going to move to the end of Zero Year, and that is Batman number 33.
That's my painting!
Is it yours too?
Yeah, this is my number two as well.
Wow, what are the odds? And folks, legitimately, we had no idea. We did not share anything about our lists ahead of time. No, so this is just a happy accident that we both ended up with the exact same issue at number two. Yeah, that's crazy. But yeah, this, of course, is the finale to Zero Year. And one of the things that Scott Snyder has done is nail the last issue of pretty much all of his story arcs. And in this case, This was – it doesn't get any better. This was the main event of the Batman and Riddler confrontation that had been building since that issue number 24 that I mentioned, because that issue ended with the Riddler sending an ominous message over a TV and cutting all the power in Gotham. And that set across the ensuing story arcs that led us to this point, where there's no power, the city's overgrown with wilderness, and Batman has to confront the Riddler at once and for all and undo him. And flat out, folks, this is the best Riddler story I've ever read in 30, I'd say in probably 28 or 29 years of reading Batman comics. This is the best Riddler story that I've read. And it takes that character and elevates him from – this whole story arc did, by the way. It's not just this issue. Took the Riddler and elevated him from an oft-forgotten, almost a joke of a character
and brought him to the level that he should be, which is one of the most intimidating and most challenging of Batman's rogues gallery. And in the process, we get to see Batman faced with what seems like a no-win scenario, where the Riddler gives him an impossible amount of time to solve these unsolvable riddles. And just when the Riddler thinks that he's outsmarted him and has proven, you know, proven his point, because they're literally unsolvable, Batman ends up one step ahead of him and solves the unsolvable riddle. And it's just, it's incredible. It is so exciting. It's thrilling, which is hard to do for a prequel comic, because you know it all works out fine, relatively, for Gotham anyway. And Gotham ends up becoming the Gotham we all know and love, because this is set in the past. But yet there is still, I remember reading this issue, there's still that pulse pounding, how is he going to get out of this? How is Jim Gordon going to get out of this? How are these other characters going to survive all this? And it's seeing that journey and seeing how it plays out that really works. And you see Batman make a sacrifice to save the city, and you see him ultimately come to his conclusion that he needs to dedicate himself to Gotham City. He, and of course, as is now a running theme with these issues we're talking about, Nick, there's that running theme of Alfred, who Snyder writes perhaps the best Alfred that I've read. And Alfred is imagining at one point what would happen if Bruce settled down.
It's pretty much Snyder doing a riff on the Dark Knight Rises setup, where Alfred, you know, in that film, Michael Caine is describing to Bruce that he used to take a vacation, and during this vacation, he would allow himself to see Bruce happy and past all of his, you know, issues that he had in Gotham, but he knew that it could never happen. And in this issue, you get to see Alfred kind of have that, where the young Julie Madison has come to ask Bruce if they can meet for drinks later or something, and Alfred looks at Julie and he sees the potential future of Bruce. He sees Bruce falling in love. He sees Bruce raising a family, and he sees Bruce becoming a happy, well-adjusted individual outside of the cave and outside of the cowl. And in that same moment, he sees that it can never happen. And it's just a wonderful Alfred moment. One of the many reasons that Scott Snyder writes Alfred probably better than any of the modern Batman writers.
Yeah, and like you said, that Dark Knight Rises scene clicked with me on a level that it didn't with some people. And I think that's why that this clicked with me as well, because Alfred is a character that, when written well, can tug at your heartstrings more than any other character in the Batman mythos, in my opinion. And in this version, it did, because it parallels what we would see later on in Super Heavy, in that all he wants for Bruce, and all he has ever wanted for Bruce, is to be happy and to be safe, like a parent would for their child. But it's almost like that parent that sees their child spreading his wings, and even though the parent wants to keep the child close and wants to keep the child protected, you have to let him go eventually. And this is Alfred letting Bruce go and letting him become what he needs to become, and that's to become Batman. And yeah, so that's pretty much my piece on the issue. Wonderful issue. Nick, take it away.
Yeah, you said everything pretty much very well. I mean, obviously, the Batman-Riddler confrontation, the finale of that is fantastic and well done. The Alfred stuff that I called out a minute ago, that was probably the main reason this made my list. But I've been saying for a while that I wanted to give a particular shout-out to the colorist FCO Placentia, and I think his work in Zero Year as a whole is probably his best work on the book. A version of Batman and a version of the Batsuit that you wouldn't really think of, that doesn't instantly leap to mind, with bright colors. The purple gloves, for example, just stand out. They pop off the page in a way that, you know, you never really would have thought of that as an obvious solution to the Batman costume. But just everything he does in the Zero Year arc just looks so different and so distinct, and helps to create this separation between this and Year One through the colors. It helps to give the story this entirely distinct tone and feel to it. And I think for my money anyway, this whole 0 year arc was Placentia's best work on this title.
Yeah, and that's something that is so interesting about Placentia, because like most people, when I think of Batman, I think of darkness. I think of bleak colors. I think of black and gray and grime and grit on the page. And in this run, it's not defined by any of that. Yes, there's darkness. Yes, there's scariness. But it is a Gotham City that is bright, that is vibrant, as you mentioned. And it's a different take, but it doesn't feel any less valid to me than what we've seen in the past. It feels like the first truly unique take on Gotham that I have seen in many, many, many years. Because I think for years people have just been kind of doing riffs on Frank Miller's version of Gotham, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And this turns it into a living, breathing entity separate from that, which is really cool.
And which is vital to the story. Overarching story of the 50 issues or what have you.
Yeah, absolutely. So with all that being said, let's get to our number one issues. And actually, let's make the people wait just a second, because before we get to that, I want to read off on Twitter. I solicited to see if anybody wanted to give their lists ahead of time of what their favorite Snyder and Capullo Batman issues are. We only got one response to this one. And that was from Russell, who is the host of the Seller's Points right here on Place to Be Nation Pop, the only place to be in your pop culture world, pop. And anyway, Russell said his three that would, he didn't have a full top five, but three that he wanted to mention: issue number one, which we've already talked about; issue number 36, which is Endgame Part 2, and this he says, Batman versus Superman in his most badass armor yet, and an incredible Joker reveal. This was, of course, a knockdown dragout between Batman and the Justice League, and it does indeed include a killer fight between Batman and Superman. Capullo just having a blast, right, drawing this slugfest between Batman and his super friends. So definitely a good issue worthy of mention. And he also mentioned number five, which is the famous Labyrinth issue of the book, of the Court of Owls storyline. The rotating art of the Court of Owls maze is incredible, beautiful depiction of a descent into madness. Now, with all that being said, we definitely hope you guys send us your favorite books after the fact. But let's get to our number one issues. And mine has already been mentioned by Nick in his countdown. My favorite issue of the Snyder and Capullo run is Batman number 40, the end game of Endgame. And this is Greg Capullo's high watermark artistically on the book. This is a perfect conclusion. For me anyway, this felt like a makeup, and it wasn't. I'm not arrogant enough to say that, because I know a lot of people love Death of the Family. I did not love Death of the Family. It left me with kind of that weird feeling at the end. This left me with such a satisfied feeling that if this were to be the last Batman Joker story, I'd be fine with it. If this were the end of the Joker being used in DC Comics, I would be fine with it, because that's how good it is. It is a masterpiece of visual storytelling from beginning to end. It is at once entertaining, exciting, terrifying, brutal, and ultimately satisfying. Which is what you want in a conclusion to a story. Is you want to leave the reader, yes, you want to leave the reader wanting to read more, but you also want to have a sense of satisfaction about what they've just read. And for me anyway, this could have almost ended the run. It was so perfect. From the brutal knockdown, drag out, vicious, personal fight between Batman and the Joker, which, as you mentioned, Nick, I'm not a big fan usually of the Joker being a physical threat to Batman, but in this case they explained it, and they wrote themselves in a way that it made sense, and it was drawn in a way that made sense. It was a Joker who was literally going for the jugular, trying to do whatever dirty tactic it takes, and it's Batman fighting back against that, and it's two people just ripping each other apart, mortal enemies. And it mirrors that sort of symbolism of the Endgame story, where it's almost God and the devil in a never-ending battle. And to see it at the end, where you've got the sadness of the tragedy of what has happened, and Alfred even tells the reader that it's a tragedy what's happening, but you also get that sense of he's still out there. Somewhere he's still out there. And if it were a movie, it'd be the perfect ending to a movie, because the ending actually reminds me of the ending to the Bourne Ultimatum, where at first you think the main character is dead, but then they leave you with that hope that there's going to be another sequel. And that's what this was. Yes, there was going to be a sequel, but if the story ended here, it would be a perfect and a fitting ending to the Batman and the Joker characters. Love it.
Yeah, obviously I agree. I had it on my countdown as well. Moving on to my number one issue, and it's one of those that you just called out for Russell mentioning. I've got Batman number 5 as my number one issue of the run. This is the issue, as you mentioned, that features the slow descent into madness of Batman as he's walking through the labyrinth that has been created beneath Gotham by the Court of Owls. And there are so many reasons I love this issue, and so many reasons that it takes home the number one spot. But I think it's the perfect example of the marriage between Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo. It has a plot concept and dialogue and a storytelling sense about it that only Scott Snyder would write. And it has a visual aesthetic that only Greg Capullo could bring to life. You mentioned earlier, Russell called out the rotating art. And obviously that is so different and so bold on the part of Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo. And indeed, the DC Comics editorial staff to allow that to go through. Just a great way of tying in, a great way of making the reader feel out of sorts and out of place, much like Batman is supposed to as he's walking through this maze. But also, Russell called out the slow descent into madness, but there's also a slow realization by Bruce over the course of this issue. Whereas to this point in the Court of Owls storyline, he's been telling himself the Court of Owls is just a myth. Their influence doesn't reach as far as I thought it, as people think it does. They're not really that big of a threat. And this issue is Batman simultaneously losing his mind and coming to the realization that the Court of Owls has always been there and that he doesn't really know Gotham the way he thought he did. And you combine that outstanding narrative with some of the most iconic issues or iconic images of the entire run. The one that instantly sticks out to me is that image of Bruce and his eyes bloodshot from being awake for more than 3 days, and his eye is almost bulging out of the cowl, and nobody but Greg Capullo could have drawn that. I have long said that my actual preferred Scott Snyder Batman artist is Jock, but there's no way Jock could have drawn this issue the way Greg Capullo did. Just brilliant from beginning to end, and truly unlike just about any Batman issue I've ever read. So, Night of Owls / Court of Owls, that's my apex of the Snyder Capullo run. It was their very first extended story arc. I know some counted as two separate story arcs. I've always counted it as one. And to me, this is the high water mark of their best story.
Yeah. That's a great issue from beginning to end, certainly. And I think that in some cases, in a lot of cases, maybe even most of the time, when there's a gimmick like that on interior art, it doesn't work. For instance, think about the Batman Superman issue that had the issue or story arc actually that went widescreen. Do you remember that?
Yep.
Where they like changed the layout and it didn't work. It was weird to read and people didn't react well to it.
I think this worked because it wasn't overdone.
Right.
It started as a standard comic and slowly changed over the course. So you got like about half the issue in your standard layout, and then about midway through, it shifts to being widescreen where you're turning the book on its side, and then for the last few pages, you're turning the book literally upside down. And I remember so many people thought it was a misprint at the time, and it wasn't. I mean, it was absolutely intended by Snyder and Capullo the entire time.
Yeah, this isn't a case of it working. Sometimes it pays off, and this is undoubtedly a case of that weirdness working out and of letting the artist have free reign, the creators have free reign on the book where it really works out. And it's definitely one of the most memorable issues of the entire run. So there you have it, folks. We have counted down our favorite issues from the Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo Batman run, the legendary Batman run of those two creators. We want to hear yours. You can tweet us at gphillips8652 or at nickduke87. You can email us, gregp@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com. You can join our Facebook page, Place to Be Nation Comics, and come join the group and come in and contribute. We're all group members there, and you know, we get a conversation on occasion there, and so we welcome your conversation as well. Let us know your favorite issues from the run, however you want to order them. And now, to recap ours, at number 5, I had Batman number 1. At number 4, I had Batman 49. At number 3, I had issue 24. At number 2, I had issue 33. And at number 1, I had issue number 40.
Yeah, for me, at number 5, I had issue 40. At number 4, I had issue 48. At number 3, I had issue 10. At number 2, I had issue 33. And at number 1, I had issue number 5.
Excellent. Well, stay with us through the break, ladies and gentlemen. When we come back, we've got reading and watching. And most importantly, we've got an exercise edition of The Rundown. So be sure to stick with us. We'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, thehistoryofwrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA on-demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apuestas podcast, The Military-Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
Batman! Why is he running, Dad?
Because we have to chase him.
Why?
Because he can take it. Because he's not a hero. He's a silent guardian. A watchful protector. The Dark Knight.
I don't get it.
Neither do I, son. But it sounds cool.
As I ride on my bike at the end of Dark Knight, there's a few plot points that just don't feel right. Like, why the hell did I agree to take the rap? Harvey Dent killed those people. Who gives a crap? And the Joker pulls crimes in such an orderly manner. He must write it down in an evil day planner. His henchmen are psycho and expendable, yet somehow completely dependable. And why is Morgan Freeman all pissed at me? He seemed to resign kind of randomly. It's okay to build me an armor tank car, but oh, tapping phones, that's going too far.
This movie of my life just doesn't hold together.
Don't understand. You can't kill a symbol, but you can kill a man.
If I want to quit, well then that's my choice.
We're all alone. You don't have to use that voice. And what about Miss Dawes? It's like you forgot her.
In Batman Begins, she was so much hotter.
Joker, are you busy? Let's call a truce. I need you to help explain the plot to Batman.
Call me insane, but I consider us friends. I brought the DVD so we can watch it again.
I'll make the popcorn and pour the sherry. Oh, maybe we can watch it with the commentary.
How does Harvey Dent do a total 180?
Well, they barbecued his face and he lost his lady.
When did you have time to rig up both of those boats?
Does talking that way ever damage your throat?
Well, at least they got rid of Joel Schumacher.
You know what movie's really good? The Hurt Locker.
Oh yeah, I've been meaning to see that.
I've never heard of that. Who's in it?
Anthony Mackie?
I don't know who that is.
He was an 8 Mile.
Oh, he was the guy who hosted the rap battles.
No, that was Mekhi Phifer.
Joker, you're getting white makeup all over the popcorn.
Sorry. Hey, did I ever tell you how I got these scars?
Yes, several versions.
Well, maybe other people here would like to hear the story.
Welcome back to the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We've got a loaded back half here. As you know, last week we skipped the rundown because we had a massive read and watching. Well, this week we don't have a very big read and watching, but we have a massive edition of the rundown. And in fact, you could say that we're going...
Oh, wow. Or in this case...
Ho-Ho Loon, still employed by World Wrestling Entertainment.
And still in the WrestleMania program. They have not retroactively erased him from the WrestleMania program to this point.
No Stevie Richards in his place thus far. very good, folks. That's exciting news for Nick and I, and I think for the entire listening audience who loves our Ho-Ho Loon updates.
Absolutely.
We'll be sure to get to you whenever we get another ticker alert. We don't know when it could come. Most likely it'll happen again next week, but we don't know that. But anyway, let's move on to the rundown. Play that beautiful bean jingle.
Welcome to the rundown. Where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the rundown. Where we talk about movies too.
Oh, that's what I like to hear. Now, to kick things off, we're going to talk about the three superhero comic book related trailers that have dropped in the last few weeks.
Yeah, not really news here so much as our general reactions to them.
That's right. Our opinions. Because you don't get enough of those on the internet, I found.
Hot takes.
That's
piping
right. Piping hot takes. That's right. And we're going to start things off with the trailer for the upcoming movie, Spider-Man Homecoming, which is coming out this summer and represents Marvel Studios' first crack at Spider-Man after years of Sony reboots and restarts. This trailer, it showed us our first glimpse of Michael Keaton as the Vulture, and also gave us...
We did get a brief glimpse of him in the previous trailer.
True, but when I say a glimpse, I mean a glimpse in terms of who the character is, not just him flying.
Talking and interacting with him.
A little bit of his motivation and whatnot. And you get a little bit of Peter and Tony, Tony Stark, that is, interacting with each other. In fact, I think you can make the argument that we saw a little bit too much of that, and a little bit too much of the Vulture, and a little bit too much of everything, perhaps, in this trailer.
I would agree. Yeah, I liked everything I saw in the trailer. Like, everything looks good. Nothing blew me away. I think still the biggest draw for me this, I think actually, not really surprisingly, but I think I preferred the first trailer we saw.
Yep.
And I think the thing that is still drawing me to this movie more so than anything else is the tone of it. Like, it looks like the, like a high school, it looks like it has, you know, one of the lines they've thrown around a lot is a John Hughes superhero movie. And it certainly still feels like it has that kind of tone and vibe to it. And
thankfully,
so,
not a John Holmes superhero movie.
Well, hey, that might be interesting. You know, I'll spank it. But anyway, so yeah, the tone is what's really drawing me to it. That being said, I liked everything we saw in the trailer. My issue is we saw too much. Contrast that with something like Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, where James Gunn has run one of the tightest ships in the entire Marvel Empire to this point, not wanting to let people know anything if he can help it. And I feel like we just saw basically the entire plot of the movie over the course of like 2.5 minutes. Now, I'm sure there are certain twists and turns that aren't in the trailer, and it still has a few secrets to reveal, but I don't know, man. I felt like it was showing a little too much for my taste.
Right. It reminds me of the Batman versus Superman trailers when they revealed Doomsday.
And had the Doomsday reveal.
It felt like too much, and it did in the movie hurt that reveal. I felt like it took away that shock factor, and in this case, there's particularly, I think, the instance that both of us were kind of concerned about was that case with the boat. The scene with the boat in it seems like a huge point in the movie where we actually see Spider-Man give up his costume to Tony, which should have been a major twist in the movie. And, you know, that's my concern with whoever cut the trailer, is I feel like it revealed a little too much. Again, like you said, everything looks good. Nothing blow away, really, except every scene with Peter and Tony interacting looks awesome.
Yep.
I agree, and
the little moment of Peter and Aunt May, like, I know, I've been a little skeptical of the Marissa Tomei casting, not because I don't think she's an amazing actress, because I've worried a little bit about her fit for the role of Aunt May, but it seems like these two are going to have a bond.
Yep.
Like, it seems like we have progressively improved upon the Aunt May dynamic in each of the subsequent Spider-Man franchise attempts. You know, Rosemary Harris was great at playing the Dust in Her Hooch version of Aunt May. She was fine. But I actually really enjoyed the Sally Field take from the Amazing Spider-Man movies, because I felt like I bought her and Peter having a true relationship where they could have conversations with each other more than I did the older version of Aunt May. And this just feels like an updated version of that, to where I can buy Peter going to this version of Aunt May for advice or with problems. I'm really digging what I've seen of that thus far.
Also, she looks like an aunt and not a great-grandmother.
That's
so
true.
But yeah, no, that was really good. But I got to be honest, one of the biggest draws for this movie to me is just seeing Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man again. I mean, I'm going to enjoy it while I can, because I know it's a sad thing for us all, folks. Jennifer, I know if you're listening, you're especially sad about this, but RDJ ain't going to be on our big screens as Iron Man forever, so we need to enjoy it while we can.
No, I mean, I think logic would dictate that it's probably... when does the second part of Infinity War come out? 2019? Is that correct?
2019,
20. So I think
maybe Dateline NBC. I can't remember which. Yeah. I get them confused.
I think we're getting pretty close, though. I think the next few years we're probably going to see a farewell to Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark, which will be a sad day for us all in the geek community.
That's right. Well, let's talk about something that was not a sad day, and that is the trailer for Thor Ragnarok, which dropped. Again, I don't want to give away our recording date exactly, but very recently to our recording that we're currently doing. And this is the first trailer we've gotten for Thor Ragnarok, which comes out in November this year. Mm-hmm. And this kind of gives you a taste of an idea anyway of the general. I don't, you know, I gotta say this though. I actually think it takes a lot of cues from Guardians of the Galaxy in that it really doesn't give away much of the actual plot. It shows you, it builds to a fight scene at the end, a gladiator fight scene between Thor and the Hulk. But I don't think that's the general premise of the movie. I think that is a very small portion of the movie that's going to lead to the overall plot of Thor trying to overtake Hela. And forgive me if I pronounce the character's name wrong there.
No, that was...
Okay.
I'm good with that.
So this trailer definitely borrows heavily from Guardians of the Galaxy in tone. Listen, I'll be honest with you. If you want a trailer to appeal to me, using a Led Zeppelin song is a great way to do it. And Immigrant Song, I've said it before, Nick. Remember when we wrote our columns about Jason Aaron's Thor run? If you read Thor comics and you're not listening to Immigrant Song, you're not doing it right. And it's just a perfect freaking fit. That song fits Thor better than any song fits any superhero in the history of superheroes. It is the song was basically written for Thor, for God's sake. Hammer of the Gods is in the song, for God's sake. So,
for God's sake.
For God's sake, quite frankly. Now, that's just my opinion. Now, maybe it's not. Maybe there's other songs that are better. Maybe Barry Manilow works for you better. I don't know, quite frankly. That's your opinion. Whatever music you want to listen to in your time is your music. My music is Immigrant Song. May not be yours. That's all right. Don't tweet at me. Don't get mad. Don't get hot, quite frankly. Thanks, JR. That was a great cut in there. I enjoyed the trailer. I thought it was funny. I thought the line about Thor saying that they're friends from work. I think Chris Hemsworth delivered that line beautifully. And I think for people, one of the few shining aspects of the Ghostbusters reboot was Chris Hemsworth and how great he is in this comedic role. And it really caught me off guard. And not that I didn't think he could be funny, because he's funny in Thor 1. He's funny in Avengers. But
man can do anything, Greg.
I am very, very excited about seeing some of his comedic interactions in this. We also got a very brief glimpse of what looks like Loki, perhaps in a more heroic role, forced into it perhaps to fight Hela. So, I'm excited about this, Nick. I know that you have been more critical of this project or more worried about this project than a lot of people. What were your takes or thoughts on this trailer?
I enjoyed everything in the first, I don't even know how long the trailer was, so, you know, if I misspeak, I enjoyed everything up until the end of the trailer. I'll put it that way. I thought, like you said, the choice of the Led Zeppelin song, Immigrant Song, pairing that with Thor, it felt natural. Seeing the oh shit moment of Hela breaking Mjolnir, while I felt like that probably could have been saved for
the
movie itself, I get why they did it, because they want to get over the fact that Hela is a threat unlike any that Thor has faced in the past. I liked all of that. Where I am going to take a little bit of a departure from people, and this is my struggle with this movie, is there is a version of this movie that I already invented in my head, and I can't help but be disappointed they aren't giving me that. And that's no fault of the people who are making the movie. So it's something I struggle with. I wanted a bleak, disaster porn version of Thor Ragnarok where just everyone is dying and people are miserable and no one is having a good time. And it looks like this movie is going to let people have a good time. And that's the only part of it that bothers me. And that is ridiculous. And I fully acknowledge that. So the bit of the humor at the end, while it was well done, it just reminded me of the parts of this project that make me apprehensive. Because Ragnarok, to me, if you're really going to tell that story, is the end of the world. And there isn't much time for jokes about friends from work at the end of the world, in my opinion, anyway. So I will take a slight departure from the rest of the geek community on that front, but I recognize it's probably a silly departure to take.
Yeah, I enjoyed it, but I get it. Everybody, you've got more of an attachment to the Thor mythos than I think I have. So for me, I very much enjoyed what I saw, and hey, we'll see how it turns out in November. But for the time being, it looks different and it looks fun different from the other two Thor movies.
My only real concern is that you mentioned the Guardians of the Galaxy influence, and we already have Guardians of the Galaxy, and I don't know. I want Thor to be his own distinct thing. I don't want too much of that approach to filter into it, you know. And that's, I guess, that's my biggest worry with this film, is that they're going to seek to ratchet up the comedy at a time that doesn't really feel appropriate for the Thor story that they're telling.
Right. I think they are going to ratchet up the comedy. I think that's pretty clear. But I honestly think it's needed in the Thor, because I feel like one of the reasons the Thor movies have not been as well received as some of the other solo Avengers movies is that, particularly in the second one, and even in the first one, there's a little bit of a and there was humor in both of those movies, by the way. Not that they were lacking in humor, but I think there was a bit of a – they become a bit of a drag at a point when it's like once you've seen them once, it's hard to go back and revisit them, because it's that we kind of talked about that a little bit when we reviewed Thor. The Dark World on multiple rewatches has, at least for me anyway, has not held up quite as well as I remembered it in the theater the first time. And I'm hoping maybe this is just a way of them doing something different and changing from the criticism of Marvel, which is that all their franchises are very formulaic. So we'll see. I mean, I get your concerns. That's how I would be that's kind of honestly where I come from with a little bit of the doomsday stuff at Batman vs Superman. One of the reasons it still doesn't sit well with me is the death of Superman was a big deal in my reading experience, and I don't feel like it got the gravitas necessary in that movie, but. So we'll see how it turns out, my friend.
Yeah, and your comments about it playing, you know, being probably helping it be more well received this time, that would suppose that I actually care about how others receive it. I just want it to be received well by me, and everyone else can go fuck themselves when it comes to the Thor movies. But I know that's not a good approach to take.
Right, and it's the opposite of the approach that you want DC to take with their movies, by the way.
I understand that. I am not unable to realize that contradiction. I think the difference is I want DC to make a movie that is well received at some point. Marvel has made so many of them that I'm fine with their Thor movies being my own little corner of the Marvel universe that I'm accustomed to.
Right. No, and I get that. We'll see how it all turns out come November. But speaking of November, there's another big movie coming out that month. Have you heard that, Nick?
I had heard that. We've talked about it once or twice on this show, I think.
That's right. And that can only mean one thing, folks. It's time for the DCEU corner. And let's get it cracking with the trailer, the official full-length trailer for Justice League, Zack Snyder's latest film that opens in November. That dropped a couple weeks ago and drew largely positive responses, it seems, from the online community. Some outliers here and there. But for the most part, people seem to kind of dig the trailer, even if there's still trepidation about the movie. I have to be honest. I told Nick this on the phone the next day. All I can do is be honest, and my honest assessment of the trailer is it left me cold. And I've said this to Nick, and I've said this to Russell, also not on the show, but on, you know, just in our real lives, which do exist, by the way, at least you know, in some manner of speaking.
Yeah, but, you heard a little snippet of our real lives on last week's show.
That's right. That's right. So I've talked with both of them about the fact that I can't necessarily pinpoint what it is that leaves me cold when I watch that trailer, but I don't laugh at the jokes. With the exception of the Aquaman line at the end is pretty funny with Gordon. And Batman and Aquaman on the roof in Gotham. That's a pretty funny bit there. But I don't laugh much at the humor.
It feels forced. That is why you don't laugh.
Right. And not only does it feel forced, but it almost feels at odds.
Yep.
With everything else in the trailer, which is this.
While they have attempted to change the tone in terms of dialogue,
it still is
and characterization, they haven't changed the aesthetic. And part of setting a tone for a film is your aesthetic. And when you have this bleak Zack Snyder BVS filtered aesthetic for this trailer, and you have people cutting jokes and making puns throughout it, it feels at odds with one another.
It really does.
My concern:
Batman firing machine guns out of the Batmobile in a world that is so dark you can barely see, and then you've got, you know, jokes like it's just very strange. And I say this: I have said this repeatedly on the show. I am a Zack Snyder fan. I am not one of these people that thinks that Zack Snyder's never made a good movie. I don't think BVS was his best work. Particularly the theatrical version, I thought was not good at all. Maybe through no fault of his own, but I love Man of Steel. I love Watchmen.
We're both pretty big fans of the ultimate cut of BVS, I would say.
Right. We both enjoyed the ultimate cut of BVS. But one of the things that I do find is every director's got their own, you know, visual style. Nolan movies look like Nolan movies. Mm-hmm. Spielberg movies look like Spielberg movies. But I feel like if ever there was a time for Zack to change his aesthetic a little bit, it would have been maybe with this movie.
Yep.
And it doesn't look like it's changed at all. It's dark.
Yep.
It's slow motion action scenes. It's not realistic, but almost this like accelerated reality version of action. This like over the top and bombastic, but still trying to look gritty.
Yep.
It did not work for me, I have to be honest with you. And like there were aspects that did.
Yeah.
The good things, Aquaman, everything Aquaman related that we have seen so far has been awesome.
The shot of Mira in the trailer.
Mira, fantastic. James Gordon looks fantastic. Yep.
Anything Batman and or Aquaman related in this trailer is awesome. Like if this movie were just the Batman Aquaman team up movie that we never knew we wanted, I would be all over it. I think where I agree with you is the feeling of the tone being at odds with the visuals in the movie, first of all. I think the humor falls flat and feels forced. Oh, one other positive. Wonder Woman continues to impress in pretty much everything she does in this trailer. So let's put her in the category with Batman and Aquaman of things that impressed. Things that did not impress. And I'll go from, slightly less worrying to more concerning in that order. The Flash stuff is still not working for me. I think the CGI is not very good. I still don't like the way the suit looks. And I feel like they are beating us about the head and neck area, for God's sake, with how quirky this version of Barry Allen is. They are seeking a way to distinguish this Barry Allen from the Barry Allen of the CW TV universe. And their version is just, make him quirky, make him weird. And I am very concerned, Greg, that we are heading down the road of getting Eisenlex as the Flash, essentially.
I think that is a reasonable worry to have. Particularly that the biggest concern for me, quirks, all that stuff is part of it. Whatever. You can do weird little takes on characters that remain true to who they are. I have yet to see anything in the teasers, in the trailers, in the leaks. I have yet to see anything that reminds me of Barry Allen as a character.
Yep. I think the only thing they've done really that was Barry Allen-esque to this point was the little snippet in BVS of him stopping the robbery, if you remember. Like,
yeah.
Just kind of out and about in his normal life and having to confront this mugger. And I also kind of like the cameo in Suicide Squad of him shutting down Boomerang. But I don't know.
That was good. I'm talking about particularly with this movie, teasers.
From
the
this
trailer.
Movie, I would agree, but much more concerning to me. And I know they have time to fix it because it is a trend in superhero movies that when a first trailer comes out months in advance and you have time to go back and fix the CGI, it often winds up being an improved product. However, after the experience with Doomsday where the CGI really didn't improve from trailer to finished product, this Cyborg CGI has me extremely concerned because, Greg, it looks awful. It looks like some of the worst superhero CGI I've seen in a long time. And I am worried I am going to just, like, be completely taken out of the movie every time Cyborg appears on screen.
Yeah, it's concerning. I mean, it reminds me of – it's a little bit worse, actually. But it reminds me of the Iron Man trailer CGI before that movie came out that was really bad and looked unfinished and unpolished. It ended up being great. So hopefully they can pull that off here. But, man, it didn't look good in this one. I do have worries about that. But back to Barry Allen for a minute and back to The Flash for a minute. That is still my biggest concern on the team as far as the characters go. Because I think what's strange to me is that if you wanted to distinguish your version of Barry Allen from the TV version of Barry Allen, you would think this would be a chance to do a more comic book accurate version of Barry Allen. Not just in terms of his looks. You could cast a blonde guy or go with a blonde version of Barry Allen. Sure, that'd be fine. But more the policeman, the by the books policeman of the Silver Age and up to Geoff Johns reinventing him in the modern era. It was always very by the book, very a nerd, but not a nerd because he was quirky, a nerd because he was just almost like Steve Rogers in terms of how out of touch he was at times. But he wearing bow ties and stuff like that. They could have done that. They could have gone with a more traditional approach on Barry Allen. Instead, they appear to have just fabricated – I don't want to say – because until you see the movie, it's not fair to judge. But based on what we've seen, this appears to be a just fabricated version of this character that doesn't seem to share the characteristics with Barry Allen that I'm familiar with.
Nope.
He seems more like Spider-Man than he does like The Flash.
He seems more like Wally West or Bart Allen than he does Barry Allen.
Yeah.
We've said that before.
Yep.
Again, I think overall I like the trailer, but it is not nearly as ringing an endorsement as many in the online community have given it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I wish I felt better about it, but I don't. Again, we talked a little bit about what it was, but there's also just some element of it that just leaves me cold, and I don't know if it's.
Also, I am still fully in prove it mode. You've cut good trailers before. I know you can do that. Can you make a good cohesive movie at this point? That's what I want to see.
A good cohesive theatrical edition of a movie.
Yes. And, you know, granted, rumors about the runtime are likely bullshit, but if we're pushing another 3-hour epic, as one of the rumors that was out there was, let's hope that at least Zach is able to fit the actual plot of the movie inside that 3 hours.
Right.
Something he was not really able to do with the theatrical cut of BVS.
But from trepidation to overwhelming excitement.
From mall to, oh yeah!
That, folks, in JR speak, that is the equivalent of 6 to midnight.
That's right.
And we are going to stick to the DCEU corner because there was a piece of great news that came out while we were in Orlando, actually.
En route to Orlando.
And that news is that Joss Whedon has signed on to write and direct a Batgirl movie. And, I mean, there's really not a whole lot to say about this that hasn't already been said, but we wanted to bring it up, and we wanted to talk about how overwhelmingly, as I mentioned, excited we are for this. I am stoked to see what Joss comes up with for Barbara Gordon, and potentially for his partnership with Warner Brothers that may, you know, if we're lucky, could lead to him and maybe some of his buddies doing a few other movies that would certainly be different in tone, you would think, from what we've gotten to this point, to provide what all that we've wanted from the get-go, which is variety in the marketplace.
Yes.
And
I don't care
this thrilling.
How much of a ripoff that people would accuse it of being. Let this Batgirl movie happen. Let it be well-received, because I almost guarantee you it will be. Then go to the Warner Brothers bank vault, wherever it is. Fill every dollar in the godforsaken vault into the back of a truck.
And put it in bags with dollar signs on the
back. With dollar signs on it, and back the truck up to Joss Whedon's front door and say, please, sir, please will you do our Justice League franchise, please? And you can say, oh, he'd just do Avengers all over again. And I would say, so fucking what?
Yeah, and quite frankly, there's nothing wrong with that, folks. What's wrong with the time limit draw once in a while? Now, this would everything you just said, Nick, is 100%. That would be beautiful. That would allow a change in tone, and it would allow us to, I think, see what we've really wanted to see, which is our favorite heroes having fun interacting with each other on the big screen, the same thing we got in the Avengers. And so This is exciting, man. I'm pumped for it. For our tastes, both of Joss Whedon's Marvel movies were excellent. That's right. Both of them. We both liked Age of Ultron a lot. So, to have him do Batgirl, I'm stoked for it. I'm really excited what it could lead to. Even if he doesn't get to do a Justice League movie, perhaps this will open the door for him to maybe do his version of the Batman family movies and do something with maybe a bringing together of Nightwing, Batgirl, and Batman in a movie, or even a movie about Red Hood, or a movie about
even outside of the Batman family. Joss Whedon doing a blue and gold movie, like that level of quippy dialogue and that snappy sense of team and family that he brings to everything. I mean, like,
hell,
there are so many possibilities for him inside the DC universe.
Wonder Woman sequel. Hell, if need be, keep the Flash movie on the back burner.
Oh.
And let Joss do the Flash.
Yes. Yes.
This is exciting. I'm very, very stoked for this.
I think my concern is that he won't want to be roped into multiple picture deals. And
Nobody wants to make nothing but superhero movies. I get that.
Right, and I think the experience with Marvel probably has him a bit hesitant. And as we've seen through this point in the development of the DCEU, Warner Brothers has not earned a reputation as an overwhelmingly easy-to-deal-with studio when it comes to these DC movies. So I think there are still some rocky times ahead in terms of Joss Whedon and his involvement with the DCEU, but I'm just hoping this Batgirl movie gets out. It's a positive experience for everyone involved, and it opens the door for Joss to take on a larger role because, you know, he is a DC guy at heart, and it's time for somebody who gets these characters, besides just Geoff Johns, to come on home and help get this ship righted because it's something that needs to happen.
Yep. Well, we're done with the DCEU for now, but let's move over to the DC TVU, the CW, the Arrowverse. And you want to talk about, oh yeah. We got not one, but two announcements.
If you feel me, stand up and say, oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Because we've got two announcements related to our favorite show, Arrow, that have us just bubbling with excitement. As if Danny Hodge himself had just walked through the door. Those announcements, and I'll tier them. They're both exciting.
Oh, of course.
First, Katrina Law is returning as Nissa Al Ghul for the season finale of Arrow this season.
Yeah.
Nissa, I believe, was last seen in season 3. Is that correct? Or maybe early in season 4?
Do not remember, honestly, but it's been a little bit.
Yes. She, of course, the younger daughter of Ra's al Ghul, the former lover of Sarah Lance, former enemy of Oliver Queen, and former wife of Oliver
Queen. Yeah, I was about to say, Oliver Queen's ex-wife.
Yes. So a character with lots of history. We are big fans of hers. She always brought it to the show. Very excited to see her come back as Nissa. Even more exciting than that, confirmation we didn't think that we would see, because Stephen Amell himself has confirmed that later this season, in time for the season finale, we will see the return of Oliver Queen's greatest enemy, Slade Wilson, a.k.a. Deathstroke, a.k.a. Manu Bennett, is returning to Arrow.
Now, we should throw in up front that Manu himself is denying this on Twitter. However, I am not buying his denial for a second. Stephen Amell has never directly outright lied to the fan base, and I don't think he would do this unless it was confirmed. I think Manu is having some fun with the
internet
the fan base.
Rumors.
Yes, and I think he is being very intentional in his wording. The two tweets in question say he is not coming back for Arrow. Because he won't be coming back for Arrow. He'll be coming back for Prometheus. He never said he'd be coming back to the show Arrow. And his other tweet says that currently the Deathstroke they are filming is not him because he's in Australia shooting the Shannara Chronicles, which is probably true. I would imagine currently they are shooting all of the action sequences with a stunt double, and that they will probably do something with him that either fly him into Vancouver or go have Amell go there for the quieter moments out of the Deathstroke mask for just the two of them, rather than having to have him on set for the entire process. So, nice attempt at screwing with the fan base, but if I've got to go with one version of the story over another, I'm always going to trust in Stephen Amell. So I am predicting at this point that Manu is just having a bit of fun at our expense.
Yep, I agree. And I can't wait, Nick.
Oh, it's going to be awesome.
Especially if the unlikely scenario happens where we get a Prometheus and Deathstroke face-off. I absolutely think that's going to happen.
My official prediction is that Oliver realizes he's going to have to continue to do unconventional things that Prometheus wouldn't have accounted for, and he will tell Deathstroke, essentially, this man, even though he says he doesn't want to kill me, is eventually going to kill me, and that honor, that's what you've always wanted, and if he kills me, you won't get the pleasure. And so he will agree to release Deathstroke in exchange for his help in taking down Prometheus, and it will put Deathstroke back out there in the wild eventually for potential future appearances of Manu Bennett in Season 6 and going forward.
Yeah, this is very, very exciting. And I really hope and believe that it's going to happen. So,
oh yeah, I mean, again, Stephen Amell said it, and I'm taking his. When it comes to Arrow, I take Stephen Amell's word for most everything.
Yep, Amell has not steered us clear. He has been a shining beacon of light in the geek community. So,
yep.
Speaking of the geek community, and speaking of DC Comics, let's move on to the printed page, where we finally got the official revelation of the Dark Knights Metal event, which is the reunion of Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo, appropriately enough, who we've talked about on this show, about how great they are as a creative pairing. Well, this is going to be their chance at doing a DC Universe-wide event called Metal, and this is going to be, they've described it as a Justice League event. It's going to involve all the major characters and a lot of the minor characters in the DCU. Can't wait to see this iconic creative team taking on some of these iconic DC characters we haven't really seen them touch.
And notably, as we mentioned earlier in the first half of the podcast, one of the key contributors to this, two of the key contributors, Jonathan Glapion and FCO Placentia, will also be coming back on board. It is truly putting the entire band back together.
Yeah, this is going to be exciting, guys. We're going to see, you know, Nick and I have been talking about seeing a Scott Snyder Green Lantern for years now. So we're going to see his take on the Green Lantern Corps. He says there'll be several Green Lanterns showing up. We're going to see Greg Capullo get a chance to draw galactic style events, I'm assuming, you know, more global scale events than we got to see in his Batman run. This is going to be very exciting, I think. Well, you know, I'm hoping that it is self-contained as they say it will be, and that it will be entertaining from start to finish, and that it won't hurt the momentum of the books that do tie into it. So I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, we've known this is coming for a while, but it's finally cool to have a name put to it, confirmation of the creative team, and I can't wait for this. Looks outstanding and is easily my most anticipated event of Rebirth thus far.
Yep. Well, a few episodes ago, several episodes ago, we talked to you guys about Marvel doing away with free digital codes from their comics. And both of us kind of thought it was not that big a deal, really, for us anyway. But in reaction to public backlash, Marvel reversed their decision, and the free digital codes are back. A pretty quick turnaround for Marvel there, and I know a lot of people are really excited about that. Your thoughts, Nick?
Yeah, this is very exciting. It makes a lot of sense. The free digital codes were something that a lot of people were really into, and their idea of replacing the one free digital code of the comic you just bought with, you know, three digital codes of old comics just was something that was doomed to fail, seeing as how pretty much all of those books were going to be available on Marvel Unlimited anyway. So it's a great example of one of the big two being willing to listen to their fans, which is something they often are not willing to do. So props to Marvel for wisely reversing the decision, and as we're going to discuss here, actually not just reversing the decision, but enhancing the original digital code program a little bit as well.
Yes, because related to that, There is a new program called Marvel Insider, which kind of takes advantage of, or is kind of Marvel's version of a the new trend in membership rewards programs. You might be familiar with, you go to the grocery store, you buy some groceries, and you save money at the gas tank, you know, when you go to fill up your car. Well, similarly, Marvel is setting up a rewards program, Marvel Insider, that will...
which apparently this is already pre-existing, but this is, they're going to tie it more heavily into the digital
program. Right, but it is new. I mean, the Newsarama article refers to it as new. So, so basically you get bonus points for, or you get points for buying comics... for at comic book shops and for buying collectibles, whatever.
For redeeming your digital codes, yes.
Yeah, well, I'm getting there. But yes, so eventually you can redeem these for prizes, for collectibles, for action figures, for bonuses, for cool stuff, basically. Well, very cleverly, Marvel, as part of this Marvel Insider program, they're giving a boost for the Secret Empire event and for local retailers, in that if you go in and you buy the way it works is you can earn 2,000 points a week by redeeming 10 digital codes at 200 points each. For each Secret Empire issue, though, Marvel Insiders will also earn an additional 1,000 bonus points on top of the regular 200 points for their digital code redemption. So that's 1,200 points per issue. And if you complete the set and buy all 9 issues of Secret Empire at your local comic shop, you can earn a whopping 10,000 point bonus for your Marvel Insider rewards. These, again, can be used for a variety of things, for buying comics, for collectibles, for digital comics, for mobile game rewards, etc. And one thing that I think is really clever on Marvel's part, they are tying this into the digital codes, because the way that you pick up points, as Nick mentioned, is by redeeming your digital codes. So those 10 digital codes for 200 points each, et cetera, that's how you're collecting all of these. And my opinion is this is Marvel's way of walking back their removal of the digital codes without actually walking it back, because what it does is it cuts into the practice of people selling their digital codes online and cutting into potential sales of the comic themselves. So in my opinion, this is a brilliant move on Marvel's part. That doesn't stop people from trading their digital codes, and it doesn't stop them from selling them. But when they do that, it does stop them from necessarily collecting these bonus points that could get them extra stuff. So theoretically, from Marvel's end, it's a win-win proposition, because – you figure most people are probably going to want to get their points for themselves, and thus you don't get that kind of secondary sales market that was opening up with the digital codes. So,
right. And it incentivizes people to go to their local comic shops.
Yes, I am for anything that does that.
So I agree with you. Great moves all around. I think the entire piece of business they're doing here with Secret Empire is a good move, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think it's a good move. I hope they do it for other events in the future.
Yes,
and I hope it's successful for them. You know, that's actually we're critical of Marvel a lot on here and DC as well. But I feel like that is a really good, wise, smart move from a company that has made a lot of those in the digital market with regards to Marvel Unlimited. So good on the decision makers at Marvel for that. Even if their editorial doesn't always get it right, they're the people that are making the bigger picture decisions do tend to get it right. So good job, Marvel. Speaking of editorial, now believe this if you will, but after a – what did we determine it was, Nick? 12-year, 13-year never-ending event cycle at Marvel – they now say, Axel Alonso says, the publisher, or was he the publisher, the editor-in-chief? I can't remember.
Something like that.
He has said that Marvel Comics, after Secret Empire, will have no more company-wide events for at least 18 months. Now, this is a shocking turn of events for a company that has defended its practice of, for 12, 13 years, literally – going from one event to the next without ever ending. a practice that has especially gotten egregious in recent years, where it feels like each event is merely done to set up the next event. So, if this is true, if this can be trusted, another great decision on Marvel's part, in my opinion. This is something we've been criticizing them for their event cycle for years. It's only right that we give them props when they reverse that finally, and take what I feel is a needed step. Even though I'm worried now that DC is going to pick up their slack now and become the event cycle company, but no, Marvel, good on you guys for turning course on this and taking us out of this just constantly draining event cycle that was honestly a huge impediment for me getting back into Marvel Comics regularly.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, books constantly being tied into events, Marvel constantly shilling event after event and relaunch after relaunch, and hopefully this will bring a level of consistency to their storytelling that we haven't seen in a while and will allow creators to just tell the story of their own books rather than being concerned constantly with having to tie everything together.
It will allow them to tell a story in the ring. It'll allow them to slow things down and just sail once in a while.
That's right. That's right. You do all the flips and none of the selling. Back in my day, people knew how to tell a story.
That's right. Now, let's move on to our last story of the week. And this is a bit of a downer. This is a... the latest comic book controversy that kind of came out of nowhere, and most people actually probably would have never known this was a thing, except some keen eagle-eye readers picked up on it. In a recent issue, actually, of X-Men Gold number 1, this is probably made it much worse, because this is a big book for Marvel. This was the flagship in their relaunch of the X-Men universe, of trying to bring in lapsed fans back into the X-Men comics. X-Men Gold number 1, which a lot of people reacted very fondly to the issue, but there was a problem. The artist Ardian Syaf, who many may know from his time on Green Lantern Corps back before the New 52, and New Guardians, I think, after the New 52. Long-respected artist. Well, he decided to go into business for himself, as they say, in the wrestling business. And without the knowledge of Marvel, without the knowledge of the book's writer, Mark Guggenheim, he put religious imagery and messages in the book, referring to controversial excerpts from the Quran, particular chapters. And readers picked up on this. And what's notable about this is Syaf hails from Where is he from, Nick?
Indonesia.
Indonesia, yes. And Indonesia is currently the site of some unrest, religious-based unrest. And Syaf, a Muslim, put these hidden messages in the work, and many have interpreted these verses as being anti-Christian and anti-Jew. And this understandably upset Marvel, and Syaf has now released a statement saying that his career is over, right, as a consequence of what he did.
One of the instances that we're talking about here is there is a image of Colossus here in this book where it actually says QS551 on his shirt, and that's a reference to chapter 5, verse 51 of the Quran, which a common English translation, this is just what I'm reading here, I have no knowledge of it, says, "Oh, you have believed, do not take the Jews and the Christians as allies." And it goes on to say some other things, but I think that is the line in question that really has gotten him into some hot water here. I think the other one, the 212 number, which is – it was used in reference to a peaceful protest in Indonesia. I think that one probably would have gotten him through with a little bit of heat, but not as much. But that – That, yeah. That Quranic verse is probably what wound up costing him his job, because Marvel did announce that they have terminated him. He completed some work for issues 2 and 3 of the series, which will still be printed, but issues 4, 5, and 6 will be drawn by R.B. Silva. Issues 7, 8, and 9 will be drawn by Ken Lashley, and a permanent replacement artist will be assigned to X-Men Gold in the coming weeks. Psyoff has said on Facebook, quote, "My career is over."
Yeah, and honestly, I, you know, I can't really feel too bad for him. I mean, quite honestly, this is all on him. He went into business for himself. He tried to get one over. He didn't talk to his co-creator, which is a cardinal sin in comics. He didn't talk to the people that were employing him about this. And frankly, if I did something like that at my job, I'd get fired too.
I agree. You know. My only concern, and it's not really a concern, but I would hope that if the shoe were on the other foot and this were a Jewish or a Christian artist working in potentially anti-Muslim sentiments into a comic, the result would be the same.
Right.
I think oftentimes in our society it is easy to criticize and ostracize people of the Muslim community and to speak negatively of them, especially in the area of the country in which we live. And my only hope is that – I hope nothing like this ever happens again. But if it were to happen and the shoe were on the other foot, that the outcome would be the same. It needs to be consistent for all messages of any potential hate put into our comics without the creator's consent.
Agreed completely. Yeah, so just an unnecessary thing that unfortunately has derailed the career of a talented artist. I'm assuming that this is a bit of an overreaction on his part. I'm thinking he'll probably get work again somewhere in the comics industry, but it would be hard if I were at DC or Marvel to trust him again without years of him proving himself again, because again, you know, they're trusting you with one of their biggest properties that's going to reach a lot of people.
And one that they have hyped so heavily, yeah, over the last 6 months, and one that features, you know, the X-Men are all about, you know, false
inclusion,
persecution and inclusion. Kitty, yep, Pryde is in this title that he drew, and she is, without question, I would think, probably the most prominent Jewish character in all of comics in terms of somebody who is actively Jewish, not Jewish as a nationality, but Jewish as a religion, and who is actively practicing, and her faith is made part of that character so inherently, and you have these messages that are potentially anti-Semitic. It doesn't make any sense. It's a mind-bogglingly stupid decision on his part.
Yes, agreed. With that said, we're going to end the rundown on that note, and we are going to transition over to...
Read on and watch out. What you been reading and watching?
What you been reading and watching?
So, as a result of us getting the season finale of Legends of Tomorrow reviewed last week, we don't have any DC CW shows to talk about this week.
And Walking Dead is over.
Walking Dead's over. We already reviewed that. So we've got none of our usual slate of comic book related TV to talk about. But just for you guys, we do still have a little bit of watching to talk about. Nick, I'm going to let you kick things off.
Yeah, so I mentioned on last week's show that I had begun the journey into Marvel's Iron Fist on Netflix, that I wanted to withhold comment until I had had an opportunity to finish the show. I have had that opportunity today, and we got some things to talk about, folks. It is no secret that I have been a massive fan of everything Marvel has done during the Netflix deal. I love the first season of Daredevil. I love the first season of Jessica Jones, to the point where I think it is the best thing Marvel has ever put on a screen, their movies included.
Wow.
I enjoy season 2 of Daredevil immensely, even though Greg, you know, wasn't as high on it. I like the first season of Luke Cage.
Now, you were a little low on Daredevil season 2 as well.
I was lower on it than I was season 1, but I was higher on it than you were. I liked Daredevil season 2.
Yeah.
I would rank it, you know, ahead of Luke Cage probably if we were doing that. But anyway, the point being, so Iron Fist came out, Greg, what would you say, about a month ago, I guess, somewhere in that neighborhood. And I didn't have time to jump on it right away, so I waited until shortly before our WrestleMania trip to begin it. And then I used today, prior to this recording, to finish up the last two episodes. And folks, I gotta say, if you haven't watched it yet, and you are expecting something that is on par in terms of quality with the other Marvel Netflix shows, lower your expectations tremendously.
I would ask you, sir, before you get into it, try not to spoil too much, because I am going to try and watch it after I finish Luke Cage, which will happen after I start Luke Cage.
Indeed. If you are expecting a show, like, you know, each of these Marvel Netflix shows to this point has been their own subgenre within the genre. And Daredevil is a brutal crime thriller. It's got the courtroom aspect. It's got the vigilante, you know, street aspect to it. Jessica Jones is a straight-up detective noir thriller. Luke Cage is kind of an homage to the 70s style of action movies that featured predominantly black cast. I don't want to say blaxploitation. I want to say, like, the more earnest films from that era. Iron Fist, judging by what the opening credits would lead you to believe, the opening credit sequence, and what we thought going into the marketing, based on the marketing of the show, was going to be a martial arts show. It was going to be a show about the practice of Kung Fu and how it translates into this Marvel Netflix universe. That is not what this show is about. This show, imagine if you will, if Batman Begins were almost entirely about the Mr. Earl scenes rather than the Batman scenes. And that's what Iron Fist is. Boardroom meeting after boardroom meeting with characters I don't give a living fuck about.
So basically, if instead of saying that the details were – that it's all a bit technical, it would have been Bruce actually explaining the technical details of what happened?
Essentially, with occasional fights sprinkled in. The characters are the Meachums, who, Greg, you will come to develop your own relationship with, and maybe you'll like them more than I did. Three of the most boring, pointless characters Marvel has put in their Netflix universe. If you think the characterization of Karen Page swings wildly and is frustrating, just wait until you encounter one Ward Meacham. Fuck that guy. Fuck his dad. Fuck his sister. Fuck them all. May Frank Castle meet them in a few months whenever the Punisher debuts. But moving on past the Meachums, who are the biggest issue with the show, Danny Rand is a bland, uninteresting character in this show who doesn't really know what he wants. He has no clear motivation, he has no clear purpose, and his plans, so to speak, are Rick Grimesian in nature, in that he seemingly just makes them up, insists they will work, and then seems befuddled when all of his plans crumble around.
It'll work!
He is also apparently exceedingly stupid in that he has been told his entire life that this is your purpose in life. And he goes against that and believes other people throughout the course of the show and is befuddled why everyone keeps betraying his trust. It is just a character that is very, very difficult to latch onto. I will say the one bright spot in the show is the character of Colleen Wing. They nail her introduction. She is outstanding from her first appearance until her last. She has the only genuinely intriguing character arc of all the characters on the show, including a twist that I genuinely didn't see coming and really enjoyed, and actually added this whole other dynamic to the show that, at this point, the show should have just been a Colleen Wing show. And if they follow it up in the future, I hope it is just a Colleen Wing show. But to go back to something, and this is where I am most interested to get your take eventually whenever you get to it, Greg. We've discussed before on the show how you are a much bigger action connoisseur than I am in terms of the physical, the actual hand-to-hand fight scenes. You have higher standards for them. I will tell you now, pretty much all of the fight scenes in this are slow, they are uninventive, and they look like somebody who is, like, it's almost like you can see Danny Rand mouthing the next steps to himself as he's moving throughout each fight. They look overly rehearsed, they don't look fluid at all, and most of them just don't make any fucking sense. Daredevil's fight scenes are leagues better than any of the fight scenes put in Iron Fist. I would say in the season there are probably only maybe 5 good fight scenes in all 13 episodes. And that, I am stretching that to the point where when you get there, I would be surprised if you find more than 3 fight scenes that you genuinely enjoy. For a show that promised me one thing, it wound up being something completely else, and it just... it's just a mess, man. The pacing, especially. The first 4 episodes are among the most painfully slow and boring things that Marvel has ever done. TV, Netflix, movie, whatever, however you want to term it. It has a shift midway through the season to a secondary protagonist, which is something that has been happening a lot in the second wave of Marvel Netflix projects. Happened in Daredevil Season 2, also happened in Luke Cage. Happens again here. And that's all fine and well and good, but they choose to wrap up the painfully slow story they've been telling after episode 12 and proceed to give us a season finale that is largely unconnected to the story that's been told and that moves at hyper warp speed through what could have been easily a five or six episode subplot, and they burn through it all in the season finale, and it goes from being a show that moves at a snail's pace for 12 episodes to a show that moves at a cheetah's pace for 1 episode, and it just feels so disconnected to the show that came before. I really dislike the show as a whole, but I will say that after the first, 5 episodes, it started to pick up a little bit of momentum. Not enough to dig it out of the massive crater-like hole it had dug with the first 4 episodes, but it slowly started to improve, and then it pissed all of that goodwill, all of that, well, maybe season 2 will be better thought that it had started to build in my head. It pissed all of that away with easily, in my opinion, the worst season finale of any of the Marvel Netflix shows and a contender for one of the worst Marvel Netflix episodes in general. Terrible.
Tell us how you really feel about Iron Fist.
Russell was too kind to it on Facebook when he gave it a 5 out of 10. I would go 2 or 3, personally. Unless you are watching this just because you want to be, caught up on the Defenders, which is the only reason I finished the show, I see no reason for casual observers to even bother with this. It is a painfully, painfully difficult watch to sit through.
Now I have to ask you, you finished Iron Fist. Did you at all have a chance yet? I know you've been busy over on Netflix to watch Earl Hebner's Iron Fist series.
Iron Fist will probably have a lot more action in it than Iron Fist will, and you know what kind of action that is up to your own imagination.
Oh my! The significance
fist with. I am officially predicting that as much as I hated this, Greg, I think you'll hate it even more than I did.
Wow!
Because I know what you were expecting from the show. We've talked about it on this podcast before, and I am telling you, it is none of those things.
Yeah,
not a single one.
This is the Netflix show that I was most anticipating because I love Hong Kong martial arts action films. I just love them. I love Into the Badlands, which is a show right now that is giving
Speaking
me that.
Of which, I was gonna follow it up with one little last quip at the show. The easiest way to improve your Iron Fist watching experience, and let me give you a step-by-step process. If you own a Samsung Smart TV that has Netflix pre-installed, go to Netflix, pull up the first episode of Iron Fist, fast forward all the way to the end. The Netflix app will then suggest to you other shows you might want to watch. It will suggest the second episode of Iron Fist, or it will suggest the first episode of Into the Badlands. Scroll over to the first episode of Into the Badlands and watch a much better version of Iron Fist with Into the Badlands.
Yeah. Well, Nick's not the only one that's been watching a little bit of comic book TV. I, when we got back from our trip, have finished the first season of the FX series Legion. And as any of our loyal listeners know, I have had a bit of a love-hate relationship with Legion from the very first episode. And the reason for that is, whereas it feels like most of the internet loves the trippiness and the weirdness and the almost LSD effect of the show, it threw me off. That's not really my wheelhouse, if you will, for art that I enjoy. However, the show had a strong hook in the lead character, in the actor playing the lead character of David Haller, and in some of the best intriguing cliffhanger endings that I've seen in superhero television. So I saw the show through to the end. I watched the final two episodes back-to-back the other day. And I gotta say, I ended up loving it by the end. I really caught myself off guard because now the second-to-last episode, I would challenge anyone to write down a cohesive narrative of exactly what was happening that entire episode, because I still have no idea. I watched it twice. And I still have no idea exactly what was happening in the middle portion of that episode. But I will say this. It looked amazing. I'll say if you watch this show, please watch it in high def. I watched most of the episodes in standard definition due to the fact that I don't get an HD feed of FX. I watched the last two episodes on Hulu in HD. Made a huge difference. It's beautifully shot. I will say that of all of the comic book television shows that I've watched, this one feels the most like a movie. It starts like a movie, and it ends like a movie. And I'll leave it up to the listeners, to if you get a chance to watch the show, to see what I mean by that. But damn if the ending doesn't feel like the setup for a sequel movie rather than the setup for a second season. But it was awesome. The last episode was phenomenal. The second to last episode was really good, even with all the trippiness. It actually served the point of the episode. What they did with the villain of this show, which is, I don't think it's telling tales out of school to say that the villain is the Shadow King. What they managed to do with the Shadow King is make him interesting to me, which he's never been. I never liked Shadow King episodes of the animated series. I never liked Shadow King comics when I was a kid. This does a great job of reimagining him. Aubrey Plaza is phenomenal in this show. But really, I want to save most of my praise for David Haller himself. The actor who plays him, whose name I am currently looking for online, full disclosure, he is phenomenal. I mean, he draws you into the character and makes you feel empathy for this guy, but also you're almost afraid of him too. It's really, really incredible. It's a very interesting show, very up and down show. There will be points when you'll be, if you're like me, where you'll be pulling what's left of your hair out and you'll be worried about whether you're going to be interested enough to watch. And then you'll be so invested that you don't want to wait a week to see what happens. The actor, by the way, is Dan Stevens. I finally pulled that up. He's outstanding. Aubrey Plaza's outstanding. And the way that they tie it into the X-Men universe about halfway through the show is brilliant, and I didn't see it coming. And it was I will say it is a lot more tied in than we were led to believe in some of the pre-production stuff. And that made me more invested in it, I think. And it's got me excited for what's to come. The way that it ended made me think that, while I was wrong about the villain for this season, perhaps we will be getting a little mojo next season. Most likely it's District 3 again, but I think there's a chance we'll get a little mojo next season. And they also left the fate of a few other characters up in the air. Loved the way that they did the mutant powers on this show. We've talked before about some of the movies are better than some of the others in the X-Men universe about showing mutant powers in an interesting way. Well, this has some really interesting mutant powers. There's a guy who has another person living inside him, and she separates from him, and they're two different people with distinct personalities or whatever, and at the end of the day they recombine back into one again, back into his body. Really interesting, really crazy, really trippy. There's a girl who is almost like Rogue, except when she touches someone, instead of absorbing their powers and memories, she literally switches bodies with them for a period of time that is undetermined. It varies wildly, basically, but she switches bodies with the other person, and then literally they wake up in her body, she wakes up in their body for a period of time. very interesting power. They're a powerful telepath that you see. There's a guy who can go into people's dreams. The really cool stuff. So I actually very highly recommend that if you do give Legion a shot, it's only 8 episodes long. Sit through the whole season and watch it and see how you feel at the end of it. Because I was ready to give up after 2 episodes, or after 3 episodes, I should say. And I'm glad that I didn't.
Absolutely. It's one that I plan on checking out probably later this summer when we're in our CW-less malaise that we often fall into. So, good to hear.
Yep. And with that being said, that's the end. We're at the end of Read and Watching. We've reached the end of the episode.
Well, actually, I've got some reading, Greg.
Oh, I forgot. We haven't gotten to the reading part. Yeah, I don't have any reading to do, so I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Duke. I've been trying to read for our spoiler alert for our next week's Long Book Hunters that we
the following week, 2 weeks from now.
2 weeks from now, Long Book Hunters of Green Lantern, Green Arrow, the hard traveling heroes, if you will. So I've been dedicating my free time to reading that. Nick, what you been reading?
Absolutely, and I'll try to make these quick, and I'll just run through these real quick. Top three, I got number 3, Batman number 20, the conclusion of the I Am Bane storyline. Fantastic imagery from David Finch, very reminiscent of Frank Miller at times, including Batman kind of narrating his interior monologue during this fight with Bane and a conversation he is having in his head with his mother, and it is wonderfully emotional and wonderfully brutal. You have the emotion of the interior monologue and the brutality of the fight, and it's one of the better Batman Bane fights I can ever remember. So, big props to Batman number 20. My number 2 book of the week, Spider-Man number 15. I have always said that my favorite Brian Bendis Spider-Man stuff comes when they focus on Peter and or Miles and his personal dynamics, like his relationships with other characters, rather than the superheroics. And this one is very reminiscent of one of my favorite issues of the original Ultimate Spider-Man, very reminiscent of issue 111, which was called The Talk. And it was the ultimate reveal of Peter to Aunt May that he was Spider-Man. And their talk about what that meant for their relationship, what it had meant to them, you know, casting new light on events that each of them had been through over the, you know, previous issues. And this kind of gives us the same thing with Miles revealing to his mother that he is Spider-Man. But not just that, Miles' dad revealing to his wife that he's been working for S.H.I.E.L.D. And so she feels like the two people she was closest to in her life have basically been lying to her for several years now. And so it's just a wonderfully emotional gut punch of an issue that features very little of Miles Morales in the Spider-Man costume. Probably not for most people, but certainly right up my alley.
Hey, let me ask you a question about that. Is it kind of like what DC – how do people in the Marvel Universe refer to Miles? Because is it kind of like DC with Wally West right now where he's Flash or A-Flash?
Yes, they are both Spider-Man. It is just okay. They wear different costumes.
Gotcha.
People in the Marvel Universe know for sure that they are different people underneath the costumes.
Right.
And that's actually one of the things is one of the recurring things since they relaunched Miles in the main universe is there's kind of been the recurring deal of a YouTube show that he and his roommate Gonkei watch, where this chick is a big Spider-Man fan and she is theorizing based on the locations he typically appears in that this may actually be a Spider-Man who is a minority, and she feels empowered by that and all this kind of stuff. So people have these theories about who the respective Spider-Men are, but it's very clear that there is a longtime Spider-Man and a new Spider-Man, but people just call them Spider-Man.
Gotcha. Cool.
Okay, moving on to my number one book of the week, I just mentioned my love of Brian Michael Bendis when he writes interpersonal relationships, and I carry that right on into my number one book, Jessica Jones, number 7. This is kind of following up on a lot of the marital drama between Luke Cage and Jessica Jones and how it relates to their daughter, and it shows one of the aspects of parenthood that I think is so underrepresented sometimes. It shows the ability of just having a child in the room to have people, even when they have a married couple, even when they are so mad at each other and have so much tension, for that kid just to melt all that tension away for a few moments, and for that child to truly become the center of those two people's worlds simultaneously. This issue alone is one of the most beautiful representations of parenthood I have seen in a comic in a long, long time. The way Bendis writes these characters, nobody does it like him, and I can't wait to see how he ultimately resolves this issue between Luke and Jessica. I think Jessica is clearly in the wrong on what she did, And I think she knows that, and I think she is trying to earn her way back into Luke's good graces, and I am 100% on board for the ride going forward. Finally, my bottom book of the week. Not that it's a bad book. I'm going with Star Wars number 30. This kind of wraps up, kind of brings full circle the little Yoda flashback story they finished up in last month's Star Wars by having Luke encounter a character from that flashback in the present day. And they do a little showdown between those two characters. Serviceable stuff, but just a great week of comics, and that's why I had to have it at my my bottom book of the week. And then my few quick hits, Green Arrow, number 20, there continues the Return of Roy Harper storyline. it's had me sold on page one when the voiceover has Roy saying, "I'm so glad you dropped the goggles. It made you look like an idiot." And Oliver goes, "This coming from the guy who wears a backwards hat as part of his superhero costume." And it was just a perfect takedown of the new 52 versions of these characters, which I continue to love. So Green Arrow number 20 nails Roy Harper and Oliver Queen for me. Aquaman number 20, continuing the H2.0 storyline with the return of Deadwater. And it just a great action-packed Aquaman issue. Has very much an alien, 1979 alien feel, where they're in this underwater base, and the Deadwater creature is slowly stalking people throughout the base. Just a really cool feel to an Aquaman comic, almost like a horror-type feel that the book hasn't really had since probably The Trench, way back in the Geoff Johns run. Green Lantern's number 20 continues the Polarity storyline, reintroducing the character of Dr. Polaris. Good issue yet again. Jessica continues to get moments to shine. Another moment here where she has to pull Simon's ass out of the fire, so to speak. And I continue to love the way that Sam Humphries is developing this character.
I'm hoping that there is, at some point, somebody calls him Mr. Polaris and he or she takes issue with it. Yep.
Right. And finally, Superman number 20, the first part of the Black Dawn storyline. This is going to be an utterly bizarre story because, Greg, there is more going on at the dairy down the road from the Kent farm than we had been led to believe, as silly as that sounds. And we're working Batman into it. We're working Damian into it. So all the best pieces of the Peter Tomasi and Pat Gleason run coming back onto the table for a story involving the dairy there in Smallville or what have you. So on board with this one, and good to see that the Superman we wanted back all along is still there.
Yeah, really excited about that one. Heard a lot of great things about that issue. Looking forward to it. So with that being said, now we've reached the end of the road. Nick, why don't you tell the good folks out there what they've got coming their way from us in the next few weeks?
Ooh, okay. So next week we will have a very special edition of Off the Page where we will be sitting down to watch Batman Forever, a film that I absolutely despise in every way, but it's something that people have asked if we were going to do at some point, and we feel the obligation to do it, so prepare yourself for that. And then we'll be finishing up the month of April, finishing up our one-year anniversary celebration and our 50th episode celebration, which is what all of April has been, with a long book hunt for the long book that gave the podcast its name, as we will be taking a look at the Green Lantern, Green Arrow run, the classic Neil Adams and Denny O'Neill run, Hard Traveling Heroes.
That's right. And we will be watching Batman Forever, and that means that we will give you all a kiss by a rose.
Lots of laundry foo as well.
Indeed. And as we do every week, we will bring both everything you see and everything you don't.
We're not doing Batman and Robin yet.
No,
that's,
not
that's
yet.
Down the road.
Not
that's down
yet.
The road.
And with all that being said, folks, we do hope you enjoyed this episode. We invite your feedback at the aforementioned Twitter accounts, emails, Facebook. Hell, if you want to send us a telegram, send it to our Vancouver studios. You can find the address online, I'm sure. Give us your feedback. We always are. We like to hear your lists for countdown, and B, we like to hear your suggestions for the show. And we have changed things based on suggestions before. Hard Travelers for Hire, which we just did last week about the Avengers. That is a user or listener requested show, rather. And We're always gonna be open to suggestions. So anyway, we hope you tune in next week, folks. And remember, I wanna address this to you, the listener. Yes, you. I know that you've done a lot. You know, you've been working a lot for the Sellers Point podcast.
Oh God.
And you've done considerable for Conversation Comics. And you've even done some things for Geek and Sassy. But I want to know what you've done for Hard Traveling Fanboys. Find out the answer to that in just a couple weeks.
To get what I'm after till the day I die. I asked Bobby Dylan, I asked the Beatles, I asked Timothy Leary, but he couldn't help me either. They call me the Seeker. To get what I'm after till the day I die. People tend to hate me 'cause I never smile. As I ransack their homes, they wanna shake my hand. Focusing on nowhere, investigating miles. I'm a seeker, I'm a really desperate man. To get what I'm after till the day I die. I won't get to get what I'm after.